And we're back.
Hey, welcome to 90.1 KFKX Radio.
So clearly we had the wrong music program, which is not the normal start to our show, but you know what? We're going to go with it.
Sure.
This is the Prop History Podcast. My name is Michael.
I'm Greg.
And we talk about props, and apparently it's the 70s again.
That's right. You just listened to Sly and the Family Stone here on 90.1 KFKX Radio.
I have no idea what just happened there, but I had to actually reset this thing to factory settings, so I think it knocked that off. So I got to go back and reset that to our standard intro music. So the next time around, it'll be back to normal, and then you get Greg's wonderful
in a
intros.
World
yeah,
where
that stuff. So Prep History Podcast, blah blah blah. Hello, Greg.
Hey, Mike.
How you doing?
I'm good. You?
I'm pretty damn good. Truth be told, we have a mighty guest on today, but we'll get into that.
Oh man, I'm so bummed that I have to bail out.
I know. Greg has to leave early, so it will just be me and the guest here in a little bit, but. If you're a TikTokerino, or if you're on the YouTubes, you're very familiar with this guy, but we'll get to that later. Greg?
Yes.
What have you got going on?
What do I have going on? I started painting R2. Mm-hmm. Now, if anybody knows me, I hate painting. It kind of terrifies me, but thankfully R2's body is...
It's one color.
It's all white. Yeah. And so I decided that, due to circumstances in my life, I probably don't need to pay somebody to paint it. Mm-hmm. And I bought a couple of cans of Rattle spray and some Rust-Oleum white satin, and because that's what the cool kids are using on the R2 buildings.
I mean, it matches, though.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And I'm slowly painting it. So I've got the feet done and... something else done, and I'm going. I don't know.
Super specific.
Yeah. No. I've got both feet done, or all three feet done, and I felt like some. Oh, I did the back panel. That's what it was. That was the first thing I did.
So is your R2 going to be? Is he going to be remote control?
I would like to eventually.
Okay.
Yeah.
So not quite there yet.
Stage one is just getting him to look like R2-D2.
Right.
And I finally got all the parts. Buddy of mine up in Canada hooked me up with the last remaining parts that I needed, and I gotta pay him back the favor when I can get them. And so I'm gonna keep working on painting R2, and hopefully in the next couple months, and then at the end of the month, at the end of October, November 1st-ish, I'm pulling the Corvette into the garage and gonna start taking it apart and put a new radiator in it and cut the nose off.
That is a daunting task. When it comes time to cut it, if you need a hand, I am available.
I appreciate that. As long as you don't, I will punch you if you applaud or anything and just like, you need a hand?
Lol. No, I will actually help.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
Chop the face off of your car.
Yep, so that's terrifying. But yeah, that's what I've got going on. You've been busy as hell here at MTS Props, and that's mts-props.com.
Thank you for the plug. Yes, I have been a busy, busy boy. For those of you who don't know, which I imagine just about everybody does, I am a prop maker, and I own a prop shop in Indianapolis.
The only one.
It is the only full-time prop shop in the state, in the city of Indianapolis, at least. And I do actually have a few proper studio screen credits. It's to my name now.
Yay.
And I have a bunch of indie film work lined up over the next couple of months, but I am, of course, the Book of the Dead and the Book of Amun-Ra are now available on Etsy.
Amazing.
Gorgeous. I'm very proud of them. On both the Etsy site and mts-props.com. I just finished up the Sleepy Hollow streets, the town sign, which is seen in the opening credits of the movie. That's online now. And I have finally, I was gifted by a wonderful young man, the production master of the Magi sword from The Mummy in The Mummy Returns.
Yes.
And thank you, bud. You're the best. I finally finished the mold on that, so that'll be available soon. And also some stuff from Starship Troopers and stuff from Galaxy Quest. All of that's going to be coming available, but only on mts-props.com.
Cool.
Because I'm going to be moving away from Etsy because the fees are ridiculous. But and then I have, I'm actually setting up my shop right now to actually be a prop rental house for Indianapolis and the surrounding areas. So if you are an independent filmmaker, mts-props.com, contact me through the contact link there, or propstohistory@gmail.com. And then I'll see what I can do to help set you up. Because I am trying to get the hours needed
what did you say? It was like 90 hours?
90 hours to join the Prop Masters Guild. Now, this is not, October 4th, I think, is when they announced it. So they kept it secret for a long time, but I've known about it for months. And I'm trying to get, because I want to be the only prop master in the state of Indiana. But I'm also, because nothing ever stops, I just did an interview, or the interview I did with WRTV here in Indianapolis finally aired.
Nice.
And I just did an interview with my local newspaper, the Martinsville newspaper, and also the Indy Star. And I also did You Seem Cool with was it Joe Gatto.
Oh, yeah.
So that'll be on YouTube here before too long. And goodness, what else do I have going? I'm going out to California, back to Prop Store for their big entertainment memorabilia live auction, which, by the way, this podcast is sponsored by Prop Store. For all of your prop and Hollywood memorabilia needs, check out propstore.com or propstore.uk. Currently, they're about to do their November entertainment memorabilia live auction with some extremely high-end pieces from Hollywood's history. Get registered at propstore.com/live auction. That's a hell of a commercial for Prop Store
right there. We should, yeah, they're going to... two things I want to talk about. I want to talk about your interview with WRTV because that's huge, but I want to stick on this real quick. You had mentioned that you're looking at doing this podcast that we do on Twitch.
Yes.
So, which would be good because I point to things a lot.
You do point to things, and you're a big fan of sight gags, which don't work.
Yeah.
But we are going to be doing this, starting here soon, doing this podcast live on Twitch. And I'll also be doing my TikTok lives on Twitch as well.
Nice.
So we'll be able to do Q&As with people so folks can ask us questions and we can answer them or ignore them or whatever happens. Because let's be honest, both of us are kind of oblivious. We'll probably miss a few. But but we are going to be starting to do this live on Twitch simply because all the kids are doing it.
Yeah.
Might as well. And there's at least a handful of people on Twitch that are interested in what we do. So
yeah, I subscribe to my buddy James Houston, 1030 JH, I think is his Twitch name. But I met him when he was a wee lad on the R2 Builders group, and like he's now a thing on Twitch, so it's kind of cool.
Well, the Twitch will all be through Props to History because I already have that set up, and I'll be doing the lives through Props to History as well. But yeah, it's nuts. Of course, when I go to LA, I'll be going back to Earl Hayes Press because I have to go to Earl Hayes Press, but I'll also be stopping in Colorado on the way home to a car museum in Colorado called Rods and Bods Car Museum. It's a movie car museum.
Oh, cool.
And they have the promotional Mad Max 2, the Road Warrior Interceptor, an actual Falcon B Interceptor. And I'm trying to convince them to let me drive it because unlike most of the cars built for that, the blower works.
Oh, nice.
So it's obscenely fast. And they probably won't let me drive it, but I'm going to pester them about it.
Sure.
Because why not?
But yeah, I mean, worst they can do is have you arrested.
Yeah, they could just kick me out. But yeah, that's among the many things going on. Those are the Cliff's Notes.
Well, the thing that made me think about the Twitch thing is that, like, we were talking about Prop Store, the big auction that's coming out, and it's probably okay to say that they're sending us a catalog because they sponsor us.
By the time this airs, we'll have it. Yeah. So,
but I was thinking, like, how cool would it be to hold up said catalog while we're flipping through it, talking about the auction, going, oh, this is what you should buy. And, of course, you can't see me pointing to the imaginary catalog because we're not on Twitch yet, and you can't see me pointing to the camera that's not there
Well,
yet.
We'll also be interviewing their director of social media on here shortly. The date's still not sort of talking about the auction, so we'll have somebody from Prop Store on here again.
That'd be amazing.
And our good buddy out there, Doug at Prop Store, has been sorting us out and hooking us up. So
Doug is my new favorite person.
I know, Doug's the best. I don't even know if he listens to the podcast.
You should listen, he Doug.
I imagine he does.
Please listen,
Doug.
We love you.
Somebody at Prop Store will listen to us. But yeah, we've got that going on. But I guess we should talk about, now I know you have to leave here shortly, so you won't be taking part in this. But for those of you who are on TikTok, those of you who are on YouTube, my good friend and Greg's friend, because we have both met him, I've hung out with this guy, I've drank beers with him. He's a good
I met him in a parking lot at the CVS.
I mean, like you do. Scott Reeder, known as Scott Props and Roll, an actual legitimate prop master. He's currently prop mastering Walker Texas Ranger. He will be on here to tell us about what it takes to be a prop master, how he got into it, and probably a whole bunch of other nonsensical bullshit, because that's how we do.
Yeah. So let me bring this back a little to your interview with WRTV, okay. Which Channel 6 here in Indianapolis, I'm sure you've posted links about it, and it's a great interview.
You can find it on youtube.com/props to history.
And I think this is important to your conversation with Scott, and it's something I would bring up if I got to be here, was that that RTV completely kind of talked at the end about the film industry, and you had talked about that in the interview, about how Indiana doesn't give any credits or grants or, you know, like tax breaks to filmmakers, so they don't film here.
Right.
One of my, I don't know what to say, favorite movies, but a special movie to me is The Fault in Their Stars, written by John Green, who's an Indianapolis writer. And if you're on the TikToks, check out Hank Green, his brother. But we got a call out on Hank Green's thingy the other day.
Oh,
you and
you?
I both. Yeah.
Somebody, oh, yeah. People were posting this. Yeah.
But that's Hank cool. Green. That's John Green's brother, mm-hmm. who wrote the book Fault in Their Stars, which is set in Indianapolis. So when they went to film the movie, they set it in Indianapolis, but they had to film it in like Pittsburgh because it was cheaper to recreate Indianapolis iconic locations in Pittsburgh than it was to film it in Indianapolis because of the film breaks.
Yeah.
And like, I love the fact that Channel 6, you know, and you got to bring this up, but like, you've started talking to state senators.
Yeah. After this interview took place, I was contacted by the press secretary for Senator Justin Bush, who actually put forth legislation to try to get the tax incentives written into law for the state of Indiana to bring film work to Indiana, which we don't have,
right?
Because there's no tax incentives, and they're not going to go somewhere that costs too much money to film. They're just not going to do it. So I have a sit down with him in the very near future to speak with him about hopefully supporting that, promoting it, and trying to get that passed. And I may end up actually speaking on the Senate floor about
amazing.
It. So it's all quite exciting.
So I got into the film business, like, you know, whatever. But like, I got into film because my freshman year of high school, it was on, I want to say it was Labor Day. Mm-hmm. It was a fall day. We had wrestling practice. I was trying out for the wrestling team, realized it wasn't my forte. And I was leaving wrestling practice. It was a day we didn't have school, and I walked by one of the buildings on my campus. Now, my campus, Arsenal Technical High School, used to be a World War II.
You went to Arsenal Technical High School?
Yeah, I graduated from there.
Right down there by Woodruff Place, where I used to live.
Yeah.
We drove past it this weekend.
Oh, yeah, I went there. And so my freshman year, I was walking past what's called the Colonel's Cupboard. It's the West Residency. It's where the Colonel would have lived during, like, when it was operated during the Civil War. There were a couple of guys putting up these black curtains over windows, and I just like, you need help? Because I had nothing to do, and I'm 14 years old and whatever. And they're like, yeah, and I had no idea what was going on. And at some point, they're like, hey, craft services will be here for lunch in a little bit. Do you want to stay for lunch? And I'm like, free food? Hell yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm like, by the way, what are we doing? And he's like, oh, well, we're setting up backdrops so we can make the inside look like night, because we're filming a movie called 8 Men Out, which starred Charlie Sheen and John Cusack and D.B. Sweeney and Mike Rooker and Christopher Lloyd and John Mahoney. Just, you know, a shit ton of amazing actors.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, I got to hang out on set. Like, I got to play basketball with John Cusack. I met Christopher Lloyd. I met D.B. Sweeney. I met, you know, like, all of these people. And, like, it's been cool because, like, John Cusack, D.B. Sweeney, Mike Rooker, and Christopher Lloyd, I've all seen on the convention circuit later. And I got to tell them, like, you know, thanks for being nice to me when I was 14 years old. And but, you know, like, right before that, Hoosiers was filmed in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And then shortly after that, A League of Their Own was filmed down in Evansville. And Rudy was filmed up in South Bend. And then it all stopped.
Yep.
We did all of these great things. And then it just all stopped.
Yep. Because the tax regulations changed. They took them away. And now we're trying to get them back so that we can bring the film industry back to Indianapolis, because we've seen it in cities all over the United States. The biggest example, of course, is Atlanta.
Yeah.
Atlanta, Georgia is the Hollywood of the South now. and it's almost overtaken Hollywood for the number of film projects that take place there. And, you know, there's no reason Indiana can't get a piece of that. So
I mean, you know, like, what was that movie about the snail and that raced at the Indy 500? Do you remember that?
No.
It was a movie. This would have been a great joke.
There was actually a plan to film it was a period piece set during the early days of the Indy 500.
Oh yeah.
And they actually found out it was going to be cheaper to film it in North Carolina than to film it at Indy 500, at the actual raceway.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the joke. So like the movie Turbo about the snail that raced in the Indy 500, they didn't even film that in Indiana. They animated that because it was too expensive to film in Indiana.
Well, it's because it was animated.
But they okay. Turbo, check it out.
Turbo. But here shortly, we will be having, once again, as I said earlier, Mr. Scott Reeder. Scott Prop and Roll from TikTok and YouTube. King of the dad jokes and also an extremely experienced prop master. So hopefully I can learn many a thing from his tutelage because I just text him questions all the time anyway. So I imagine he's sick of me at this stage, but he's agreed to be on the podcast.
Give me a dad joke about knives.
Right. Well, I'm asking him actually like...
Oh, real questions?
Like prop making questions and stuff like that. Oh. So
maybe that's why he doesn't respond to my texts, because I just asked him. I need a dad joke.
You just need dad jokes.
I need a dad joke about tiling the floor.
You just need to get on the TikToks and listen to all those dad jokes.
That's, he's great.
No, Scott's awesome. When I went to Austin, he showed me around pretty much everything that he does. I was able to go on to a couple of different sets, and I don't want to say the names because I don't want to get him in trouble, but showed me all around the studio down there in Austin and his prop house that he owns, and he introduced me to a bunch of people down there. And he's just genuinely a really chill dude. It was a lot of fun meeting him, but then also there's a fantastic connection for some schmuck who's trying to get into the film industry, truth be told. And being as I'm one of, let's be honest, so there's very few people here. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of talent in Indiana.
Absolutely.
That want to be in the film industry, but there just isn't one. Yeah. So hopefully with his guidance and what I'm able to do with this nonsense that I'm doing here at MTS Props, which you can find online at mts-props.com, because I'm never going to stop doing that. No, and also props to history on the internet, anywhere else on social media. Hopefully we can maybe just give it a nudge at least to help get the film industry in Indiana, because it's a great location. We have enormous amounts of different types of scenery available and set locations.
I mean, just the cost of living. Oh, I mean, it makes everything so much cheaper. Right? Years ago, I got invited out to the ranch, Lucasfilm. And
jerk.
Well, we'll go sometime.
I've never been invited to Lucasfilm, Lucas Ranch, or whatever it's called, Skywalker Ranch.
Yeah. So I got to go to the ranch, and like, you know, when I was talking to my buddy out there who worked there, he was working on episode 2, I believe. At the time, that was what, 2000, because it was right after 9/11 happened when I went out there. And like, he was paying like $1,200 a month in rent for this tiny two-bedroom apartment, and my mortgage was $500 a month for my 2,000 square foot house, and it's like I can't, there's, it was just like the dream deferred. It was like,
oh, absolutely,
you know, like I could never afford to have this job.
It's like a guy that I've met and I've been able to tour his studio, Fawn Davis, who started out working on Star Wars episode one, I think.
Yeah, he was part of that crew.
Part of the ILM and Adam Savage and
Don Bees and John Eblin and Grant Imahara?
Yeah, Grant Imahara. I got to tour his studio, and it was awesome. It's amazing. I would absolutely love to work there. And he just posted on the internets, on the Facebooks, that he had openings for model makers, which is what I got into this to do, but model making fell by the wayside. And it's like, it's just like, it makes me like kind of hurt a little bit, because it's like, that is the job that I absolutely wanted, but I cannot afford to live in California.
Yeah.
So I want that kind of stuff here in Indiana. If not for me, then for people down the road that, like me, live in the Midwest and it's just not accessible. So there is work in Chicago, but it's not a huge amount right now, because even their tax credits aren't that great. Not like they are in Atlanta or like they are down in Louisiana or New Mexico. So I'm hoping that we can at least maybe open a little bit of a door to show the people in charge here in Indiana that it's worth it.
Right.
It'd be fun to turn this into the Hollywood of the Midwest.
That would be awesome. And we can make more John Green movies. So.
Yeah, it would make a ton of money for the state, and it would make a lot of jobs and help the infrastructure and everything else. So I don't see why not. But here shortly, we will have Scott Prop and Roll, and unfortunately,
I got to bounce.
Greggy must leave us.
Yeah, sad panda.
But we will be on here in a second with Mr. Scott himself. But
give him my love.
I will give him your love. Do you have any questions for Greg? Or for Greg, do you have any questions for Scott? You got any questions for yourself?
No, I just can't wait to... I will actually listen to this podcast.
Do you not listen to our other podcast?
No.
You don't listen to yourself?
No.
Maybe that's why I'm...
Should I?
I listen to our podcast because I want to, like, I listen to him as I edit him,
which
we've established in the past that I believe editing is lying. So we don't really edit anything. No. We just post it as we recorded it.
Is it lying or lazy?
It's mostly lazy.
I mean, we're just...
I like to call it lying because editing is lying looks better on a t-shirt than editing is lazy. But I go back and I listen to my voice because I like it.
Oh, no, This is me being vain. If I write something, I will read it over and over again. Like, man, that was good. I wrote that well. Or it'll be like, oh shit, I forgot to put a comma here, or like I used the wrong word.
I guess we'll stop your segment here, and then we will go to a commercial.
All right.
And by a commercial, I mean,
do we have any more of that 70s sound?
You know what? We'll lead you out with the sultry tones of funk. Maybe. We'll see. There it goes. See you, Greg.
See you, man. Hey, next up, Mike Corey here on 90.1 KFKX.
We're probably going to get sued now. And we are back, and I am here with our guest, known as Scott Prop and Roll on the TikTok and YouTube, actual prop master, Scott Reeder. Welcome, Scott.
Hello there.
Thanks
for having me.
Thank you very much for being on here. Now, you are based in, you're based in Austin, correct?
I'm in Austin, Texas. That's correct. I'm working on a television show called Walker for the CW Network.
Yeah, and it's just is it a continuation of the old Walker Texas Ranger or a brand new story?
No, it is a kind of a reimagining, okay, you know, of that story. No, it's its own thing. It really has nothing to do with the original, which I did work on.
No, you did work on the
original. As a prop fire.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I did 196 episodes of the original Walker Texas Ranger with Chuck Norris.
So what's Chuck Norris like?
Great guy, super nice guy. I mean, I know people are always saying that about actors. Oh, he's a great guy, but he truly is a very, very nice, caring, good man. He was a good boss for 8 years, so I have no complaints.
That's cool. So now you and I met through TikTok because you're on TikTok, of course, as Scott Prop and Roll, and you're known for just talking about movie props and also some of the best and worst dad jokes I've ever heard. And now, of course,
I can't help myself.
I know you're about it, and of course, now you've moved over to YouTube, which you've seen tremendous success on here recently. But for a lot of people that have probably heard the term may not know what exactly is a prop master.
All right, a prop master is someone who's in charge of anything touched or held on camera. That's the general, quick version. I don't do couches. I don't do paintings on the wall. There's a set decoration crew that'll come in and make, like, if you're filming in a house, they'll make the house look lived in. Mm-hmm. They'll put, trash on the counter. They'll put dirty dishes in the sink. They'll dress it according to what they read in the script. But if it's a prop that's scripted, it's me. If it's a guy walks in with a gun, I provide the gun. If it's a bar fight, I provide the all of the drinks and the practical drinks, real glass bottles, real glass mugs. If there's a bar fight, I will switch all those out with breakaway beer bottles, breakaway mugs, and all that. I'll do the near beer. I'll do fake whiskey. I'll do, fake red and white wine. Basically, like I said, anything touched or held is kind of the term. Mm-hmm. And a prop master on a television show is a lot different from a prop master on a feature film.
Right.
And the reason being is in television world, which I'm in currently, I am in what I call perpetual prep. So while we're filming episode one, we are prepping episode two. So I'll get in early, get all the props, get everything together, organized, pass it over to my set crew. They'll work the set while I go off and prep the next episode and meet with the director. I do a breakdown of the script. I read the script, make a big list of all the stuff I need. And then I'll start either buying it on Amazon, buying it locally. Hopefully, you know, you try to get as much locally as you can put into your local economy. Anything you can't do that, you do, we'll buy on Amazon or whatever, and then we'll, the first thing you tackle are the items that you have to fabricate. So you'll either make them yourself, which we typically don't have time to do. So we'll divvy it up by, you know, if I've got a friend that's really good with electronics, I'll hire him to make the detonator device that, or a hidden camera or whatever it is that's scripted. And if I need a rubber M4 for one of the SWAT team members to get hit over the head with, I'll hire someone to mold the gun for me.
Right.
And so we'll just, but it, on a feature film, you'll have, you're typically given about 8 weeks to prep. You'll go through, you'll meet with the director, you'll buy, you know, you'll get a bunch of choices for the director to choose from, show pictures of stuff. You get them to decide everything before you start filming. Then you get everything loaded up on the truck, and the prop master is on set. So right. I will work the camera on a feature film and be there with the director and hand the props to the actor. That's on a feature film. So that's the difference, is I have someone to handle the set for me in television.
Okay. Now, isn't there also something weird left over where the prop master also deals with the director's chairs as well?
Oh, yeah. And I have no idea. My joke is that a butt kisser on Gone with the Wind said, "I'll do it." And it was the prop guy.
And now it's just forever that.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you actually end up getting started and end up becoming a prop master? Because I know there's not a whole lot of prop masters.
Mm-mm. Well, what I'm trying to think of the short version. I was going to University of North Texas in the Dallas area, north of Dallas, as a sophomore. I just moved there from Beaumont, and I at that point I knew I wanted to get into film production. One way or the other. Didn't know what I wanted to do, but I've been a movie fan since I was a little kid. My mom was real big into the classics, and so I knew I wanted to be in media somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a university event. Can't remember exactly what it was, but I ended up meeting someone who was an administrator at a hospital. And he happened to mention there was a movie filming at his hospital on, like, the next week. And I was like, oh, really? Well, I really want to get into the movies. So he told me, it was like, whatever, on like Wednesday of next week, they're going to be at the hospital. So I went up there and just ended up running into a locations guy and said, I'm a student here, here in town. I really want to help. I'll just pick up trash. I'll do whatever you want. I just want to get some experience and be around it. And that person, he directed me to the production office and told me where it was, which they were the production office. It was for a movie called Daddy's Dying, Who's Got the Will, with Bo Bridges. Oh, geez. Judge Reinhold.
Oh, man.
Who else was in it? Beverly D'Angelo, Bo Bridges, Judge Reinhold, Tess Harper. I can't remember who else. Oh, Keith Carradine.
Oh my!
Which I that was amazing. I honestly drank Southern Comfort with Keith Carradine, who was in the movie Southern Comfort.
Oh wow!
Have you seen it?
I have. Yeah. Right? Yes, I have.
Oh man, I love that movie. Powers Booth is awesome, Keith.
Well, Powers Booth was awesome in anything that Powers Booth was in, so.
Mm-hmm. I'll say the best Powers Booth performance, in my mind, is where he played Jim Jones in the TV miniseries about, you know, the Jim Jones tragedy.
Yeah. Whenever somebody brings up Powers Booth, I always think of By Dawn's Early Light, where he was the B-52 commander.
I did not see that.
Well, it takes place right at the beginning of a nuclear war, like a fictional nuclear war, of course. But it's the same set that they filmed Doctor Strangelove on, because it still existed at that point. It was the most accurate B-52 cockpit flight deck that they had, and it's the same one from that movie. And I think that's probably the only reason it pops into my head, because that's kind of my shtick, is following all that stuff.
Yeah, he was amazing. But yeah, and Keith Carradine was good too. So I ended up go to the production office, and I offered up my services, and they said, well, you know, the prop department, they're really light. They only have like two people in the prop department. Maybe you can help them out. So I did, for the rest of that film, I worked prop department. I went from there to working location scouting for the North Texas Film Commission. I took anything I could get. There was by working at the North Texas Film Commission, one of the neighbors next door was a little production company. There was a studios at Las Colinas. There was a movie studio in Dallas back in the early 90s. And there was a company that did nothing but karaoke music videos. Now, early 90s, karaoke music was huge.
Oh, yeah.
And the karaoke music videos were a big deal. So they were all super low budget, but, you know, when you'd go sing karaoke, there would be a full-fledged music video, not just words on top of a colored screen.
Right.
Like it is now. But, you know, so I would... I just kind of did a little bit of everything. So, you know, then I went on to the prop master of... Then we found out that we're going to be shooting a movie in town called Finding the Way Home. It was called Middleman's Hardware. It was a TV movie for ABC. Came to my same town, and it was George C. Scott, Patton.
Oh, wow.
And George C. Scott, Hector Elizondo... I was just in awe, you know.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
Was the first time I was like around a full-fledged Best Actor Oscar winner, and so that was pretty cool. Then Necessary Roughness came to town. I just happened to be going to school there when three decent sized movies filmed there. I ended up getting the second unit prop job on Necessary Roughness, and I dropped down to like 6 hours in night classes so I could do do the whole movie.
Right.
And that's where I really cut my teeth doing props. That was like 91, so, and this was all before I didn't graduate college till 93. Mm-hmm. So by the time I got my degree, I had probably four movies under my belt and numerous like videos, music videos, industrials, and I'd done a little bit in everything. I've done PA work. I was doing like camera PA work. I learned a little bit about everything, but I just kind of did more prop and art department work.
So you came out.
That's kind of. I really enjoyed it. That, that
so, You entered the industry from school pretty well loaded on your resume then.
Mm-hmm, I did. And it was the day after I graduated in 93, spring of 93, I got hired on as a camera PA for the Bud Light Spotlight Tour, where it was a small condensed film crew. And we just traveled around Texas and Mexico filming. We hit 3 bars a day, and we just put a Bud Light in somebody's hand and say, why do you like Bud Light? You know, or tell us about what you think about Bud Light. And that was all we did. I was the clapper dude, but I did get to learn all about, I would set the camera up. I would put the, you know, filters on. I learned how to pull focus. I, you know, did all that. When I just finished that, we hit like 148 bars in the summer, throughout that summer of 93. Then, the guy that was my boss on Necessary Roughness called me up and said he had this show called Walker, Texas Ranger. And boom, I was on that forever. I couldn't get off of it, but you know, it was that's where I really cut my teeth.
Yeah,
did a ton of learned a lot on that.
Yeah, no doubt.
It was network television, but man, you're pounding it out fast.
Yeah,
and it was, and on that show was a lot of action. That's where how I learned a lot of the tricks of, yeah, we were constantly needing, you know, rubber bricks, rubber guns, rubber knives, retractable knives. Breakaway beer bottles. That's where I really learned, you know, all that stuff. Because we were doing it every week.
All the little secrets that most people don't know about, kind of thing.
Yeah, stunt dummies and all that. But to tell you the truth, Mr. Props to History is my true. I really, the whole time, I longed to do period films. So I went for years. So I worked 10, 12 years before I had a chance to do a period show. I mean, and I don't really count. We did like some flashback episodes on Walker where he played an old Texas Ranger. And we did shoot in like Western Town and whatnot. But that was my only little taste of doing a period show. And it, you know, maybe it was, I'm trying to think of when I did my first period show. It was, but I love them. I love doing that. I did 1963, right? The JFK show.
Right.
Parkland. And I loved it. I delved into the research. I got to talk to people that saw that were witnesses to the JFK assassination. One of the main journalists with the Dallas Morning News, Hugh Ainsworth, I got to hang out with him, and I invited him in, and he was an extra in it, like on the grassy knoll in Dallas, right where he stood years before and witnessed the real thing. It was just crazy. And I had always, you know, especially with I've never been a, some people will obsess on one, you know, historical event. I've never been like that, but I feel like this, I feel a little more drawn to the Kennedy assassination just because I was in Dallas for so many years.
Yeah.
And I would buy a lot of our gear for Walker at the Beacon Army Navy store. Right.
Yeah.
And it was on McKinney Avenue in Dallas, and it was this old Army Navy store. And I kid you not, working the front counter, and she worked it for years, was Marina Oswald Porter, Lee Harvey Oswald's wife.
Holy moly!
At Beacon Army Navy, and I got to know her pretty well. You did your best to just let her talk to you, and if she wanted to say something about the old days, she would.
Right, but otherwise no.
But she was not a big fan of movie types, or especially producers, because around the time I started going to that Army-Navy store and seeing her was right after they had done the movie the Marina Story starring Helena Bonham Carter back in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And I guess she wasn't happy with the way she was portrayed in it. To be honest with you, I never saw that movie, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But she, she was a very interesting person to hang around. And she would, she would go off on the film industry on several occasions.
Yeah. I guess you were.
But yeah, so I felt. So it was really neat to me to do the research and learn so much about what went on in Dallas on the when Kennedy was assassinated. We were replicating the Secret Service and the whole entourage going to Parkland Hospital.
Yeah.
And so I had to actually talk to doctors that had tried to resuscitate him and
they were actually involved in it. Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. That's but fantastic. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. But we actually filmed all that part. The only thing we filmed in Dallas was at the Grassy Knoll. That was with Paul Giamatti played Zapruder.
Yeah, you still have the camera from that too, don't you?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. It was a Bell and Howell director series.
Yeah.
And I had to match the glasses. That's one thing when you do a period show or something shot pre 1980 would be that probably 40% of the people that you would see would have what do you think would be different from today versus this is a quiz, Michael.
Okay,
what do you think would be different? You're walking down the street, besides the the style and fashion.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is different that would affect 40% of the population that you would be definitely noticeable?
Would it be their eyeglasses?
Boom.
Okay.
Wow. First guess. Yeah. So about 40% of the folks just walking around would have eyeglasses.
I have to admit to you that I knew that because I'm currently trying to put together glasses for a period piece that's set in the late 1800s. So I'm having to hunt down that style of glasses, and it's not the simplest thing.
Well, I got a prop shop.
I know that you have a prop shop.
I probably have some.
Well, I may have to talk to you about that, and I actually I now have my own prop shop too. So I know it's not as extensive as yours because I've been in yours and I know for a fact that it's not, but I'm getting there. But I'm also the only prop shop in Indiana. So that's that.
There you go. Well, for those, just do a lot of eBay and then find what you need for your heroes. You'd find a good local, optical dispensary or, ophthalmologist or optometrist to do your non-glare lenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually managed to luck into a pile of that period of glasses that was actually being sold by Prop Store. And there's another way for me there's another way for me to plug my sponsor because they sponsor this podcast.
There you go.
Nobody knows.
Were they mainly the gold rim?
No, it's a mixed bag. Various types of. Silver and plastic and the early Bakelite. Some of them are from the 1910s and 1920s, but
okay, gotcha.
They're nobody knows what movie they were from, so they just sold them as this big lot of like 20 pairs of glasses, and I bought them for $50. So not bad.
Yeah, I don't know if you feel the same way I do, but I've been to auctions and stuff, and you'll find something like, and I don't have it anymore because I sold it, but I probably should have hung on to it. Like I had a Bugle that had an MGM Studios tag on it.
Oh wow!
And but there's no way in knowing what movie it was.
Yeah. I have a camera from 1937 that is labeled Warner Brothers Grip Department, and it's one of those the wind up movie cameras from that like the 8mm. It's a Cine Kodak. And it has a guy's name on it, Stan Sneed. And I know that he worked on the Maltese Falcon, but I don't know what he did, and I'm not sure why this camera is marked as Warner Brothers, because it's not a film camera, per se, not one that they would film a movie with. So I'm not sure what he used it for.
Hmm.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Like, yeah, I can't. So many mysteries that are going to go unanswered when it comes to that stuff, because it was so repurposed. It's like, I mean, and I'm guilty of it as anybody. I mean, so many of the props I have been, you know, some of them have been in 6+ productions, or who knows how many commercials, you know.
Now, when you have a
When
you have a piece that's like very specific to a film that you have to either acquire or have made, and it's something that would be instantly recognizable from that movie, and you can't reuse it for another, what do you do with those?
Well, I'm kind of a pack rat.
Yeah, I know.
So a lot of times I'll hang on to stuff.
I've been there. I know.
A lot of times, you know, some studios will want everything, and then they'll have a yard sale.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'll go in and I'll say, okay, well, I'll pay a certain amount for a lump sum, or I'll take all this stuff off your hands before, or I'll put a pile together of stuff I want, and then I'll work a deal with the production company and get my pile before the yard sale happens.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm like, I don't want someone buying that for $3.
Right.
because no one has any idea what this stuff's worth. Or that's the funny thing is, typically when we buy items to use in shows, we'll depreciate it. We'll sand it down, we'll alter it, we'll repaint it. So its value as whatever retail product it was before, it's definitely depreciated.
Yeah.
But if that show, and it could be years, it could be you could be working on a show that did not do well initially and then later becomes a cult classic, then all of a sudden that depreciated item that you have that's worth 50 cents now because you ruined it is now worth $500.
Right.
So,
or more based on how that market is now.
Yeah. Yeah, especially if you have the Trilogy of Terror.
The Zuni doll?
The Zuni doll, I couldn't think of it.
I actually...
But yeah.
I have one of those now. It's actually cast from the production molds. So it's
that's awesome.
Yeah, so it's based on the one that was actually movable, but it doesn't move because it's just the parts are cast and then put together that way. But I was like, I need to make a mock up of this and just send it to you. Like, no idea that you're gonna get it. Just so that you open the box and all of a sudden that absolute horror show is in your face.
Oh, and you know what? You have to rig it to where the
it, like pops out,
where the belt comes off.
Yeah.
So that releases. Make sure it releases the demon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because I know that movie disturbed you when you were a kid. So.
Oh my gosh, that would be imagine.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You're 5-6 years old.
Yeah, no,
And what's hilarious is how many people commented on that TikTok.
Yeah.
Yeah. That they were about my same age, 50, 51, and they all had the exact story of they were allowed to watch it and it haunted them for years.
Yeah.
It was, you know.
I think it was like 91 or 92. I was 12. My parents rented The Thing. 1982's The Thing, and I was not allowed. I was not allowed to watch it at all. But I snuck down into the living room in the middle of the night and watched it anyway. And it just absolutely ruined my sleep for days.
Oh, I bet. Oh my gosh. Well, I think I probably saw it. So I was 12 when that came out.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I saw it maybe at 14.
Yeah.
So, you know, when it came out on, you know, on Showtime or whatever.
Right.
And, this is how big of a movie nut I was. So I was like 13 years old and we had cable at our house.
Mm-hmm.
Downstairs, my house, my room was upstairs. We're in a 2-story house. And I figured out, I went to Radio Shack and figured out you could buy, I found a T-splicer for a coaxial cable, for the TV cable.
Yeah.
Right? When my dad was at work, I went up, got on a ladder, and spliced into the cable line that came off of the pole, right? And ran cable through the air vent into my room.
Oh my goodness.
And so for a couple years, my parents never came upstairs. So for a couple years, I had cable upstairs and they had no idea. And I could watch Showtime and HBO or whatever it was
So
that's how I got to see the thing.
You heard it first, folks. Scott just admitted to a felony.
No. We were paying for the cable. I was tying into the cable once
he
got to our house.
Statute of limitations is passed by now.
My dad would have...
probably not been happy.
Yeah. Well, he eventually saw that what I had done. He was kind of impressed, I think. He's like, "Wow, you did that?"
I mean, how could you not be, truth be told?
Yeah. Well, and then, but I had to troubleshoot because then the signal wasn't that great because they'll only pump enough signal to like operate two televisions, right?
Right.
So, because they don't want people doing that splicing and whatnot. But I went back to my buddy at the Radio Shack and said, "Okay, it's a weak signal. It's fuzzy. What can I do?" And the time you could buy an amplifier, so I plugged in this amplifier and it amplified the signal, and I had really good, crisp, clear cable, and watched the thing up in my room, and was
completely
traumatized as well. But
as is tradition.
Another one that I saw as a kid that was traumatizing, and I didn't know it was a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a horror comedy. Have you seen, I may have asked you this before, Theater of Blood with Vincent Price?
Oh, God, yes.
You have seen
it? Oh, yeah. Those old classic, like anything Vincent Price horror movies were on the list when I was a kid.
It was not your normal Vincent Price thing, though. It wasn't like The Fly or the Rue Morgue. This was like kind of hippie version of Shakespeare, where it's a Shakespearean actor who he's getting older, and all the critics just pan his latest play.
Right.
They just rip him to shreds, and he goes crazy and creatively, takes him out. I don't want to give too many spoilers,
right?
Because if your audience is listening, that's a great. Oh my gosh! And the like I said, when I was a kid, I didn't get that it was it was a dark comedy.
Right.
And there are some really funny, just dry British humor jokes in that. As an adult, you can watch it and crack up.
Yeah. For a kid,
it's you can be horrified at the same time because it's still creepy and spooky.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm trying to
remember my top picks.
I think the first time I saw Hellraiser was, I think I was 13 or 14 years old. Right around the same time I watched The Thing, actually. I watched it over at a friend's house. And Clive Barker's Hellraiser, the very first one. And that scared the crap out of me for the longest time. And then I kind of became a huge fan of horror after that. And just sort of kept consuming as many different horror films as I could. And I mean, all through high school, I was doing as me and a couple of friends of mine were just obsessed with horror movies. And it wasn't, and I didn't get disturbed by any other horror movies until we started watching horror movies from Japan. And there was one called Ju-on, which they remade as The Grudge here in the United States.
Yeah.
And it was by Takashi Miike. And I remember that was actually the first horror film that ever made me lose sleep. And to this day, I won't watch it again.
I haven't seen it, so now you got me.
Yeah, it's properly terrifying. Like, Takashi Miike is pretty much the Clive Barker, Wes Craven in Japan. He is the master of horror in Japan. And any of his movies are just absolutely fantastic. But that was the first one I ever watched that made me lose sleep.
Well, when I saw Hellraiser, and one of my first thoughts was, I would never want to sleep in the same house with Clive Barker overnight because he is, that guy's messed up.
Uh-huh.
Like, how do you come up with this stuff?
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I'm a bigger Wes Craven fan. I mean, I was a huge fan of Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh yeah.
And then not part two. Part two, I didn't like. Part three, I thought was great.
Part three was probably one of the best ones that came out.
It was definitely more commercial and a bit more friendly to slightly younger viewers, but it was definitely more palpable.
Mm-hmm. It also had a higher budget than the rest of them too.
Yeah, that's true. Who was the guy? Oh, the guy in that not older guy, but he was the grown up in that. Craig Wasson.
Okay.
was the main character, Craig Wasson, who was in a Brian De Palma movie. Body Double? Is that right? You talked about veering off.
I'm all about it. That's what this podcast is, man. It's different paths.
Yeah.
No, it's all good. Let me ask.
Yeah, but anyway, Craig Wasson was in Nightmare on Elm Street 3. I did have the opportunity to work with Robert Englund, who is the most non-Freddy Krueger you've ever met. I mean, he's just the sweetest guy, and he'll sit and talk for hours.
Oh, that's cool.
He had so many stories, and he was he did not put on airs at all, and he didn't act bitter that he was typecast into Freddy. He was like, man, what a great gig I got. How about that?
Yeah, he pretty much is Freddy, and I think only one other actor has played the character besides him. It's very much the same with Pinhead. I think only one other actor has played Pinhead besides the one actor who's always done it, and it was in the most recent film, but it's always Robert Englund. I can't see Robert Englund and not see Freddy.
We had him in an episode of Walker. We either got him, except for Robert Englund. Robert Englund went on to do more Freddy Kriegers after I worked with him. But one thing I noticed about working on a television show like that, just a standard 1990s network TV show, it was for CBS, is you'd either get actors on their way up or their way down. They definitely weren't at their height. You know what I mean? We'd have like Tobey Maguire before he was Spider-Man, or Giovanni Ribisi as a kid, and a ton. We'd have we'd have Stella Stevens, who was in her prime, a well-known '60s actress, she was in the original Poseidon Adventure.
Oh, wow.
Played Ernest Borgnine's wife. We had Stella Stevens, or we'd have Howard Keel. Rod Taylor, who was, the Hitchcock's The Birds, the main male lead from The Birds. So we had Rod Taylor. We had Brian Keith, from Family Affair. So I got to work with so many of these classic Hollywood actors. That's one of my favorite memories from working on the original Walker was the older actors that they would bring onto the show. It's similar to like Murder, She Wrote. Angela Lansbury had lots of classic character actors from old Hollywood be in her show.
Yeah.
And it was similar, not as cool, but similar to Murder, She Wrote in the sense, we had Lee Majors, who was Bionic
Man.
Yeah,
the Bionic Man.
Oh my God, I could go on for days. We had Hulk Hogan. I got a Hulk Hogan story.
Oh, so, tell it.
So he was in the production office signing his paperwork and whatnot, and I had already gone through the script and knew we have a scene where he gets arrested. His character gets arrested, and I went and grabbed the prop handcuffs because I knew we had to, and I said, hey, I just want to see if you're okay with these handcuffs, put them on you. He goes, oh, they won't fit, man. They're not going to fit, man. You have any leg irons? Go get some leg irons. So I'm like, okay. I was, and then I looked at his hands. I was like, oh my gosh, they were, his wrists were like 8 inches across. I was like, oh my god. So I got leg shackles and they fit perfectly on his on his wrists.
Oh my goodness.
I just shortened the chain to where they looked like handcuffs, but they look on him, they looked like handcuffs. They were proportionally perfect.
Oh my goodness. I met a guy who got to work with, he worked in the wrestling industry back in the 60s and 70s, and he actually got to work with Andre the Giant for a short time in New York. And he said, oh, that wow. You said you cannot fathom the size of him from a picture until you're standing next to him. And this fellow is like 5'9", pretty average height fellow. He's like, I felt like a tiny child in the presence of Andre the Giant. So some humans get big, and it's weird when it happens.
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's the same way, like, if you go to, like, a pro basketball game, you're like, oh, my gosh.
Like, that's a human? I didn't know they made them that big.
Like, yeah, because I saw in person, like, Dirk Nowitzki or something like mm-hmm. that of the Dallas Mavericks one time. But we had other wrestling greats on Walker. Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Oh, man.
They Live.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
Right? Is that right? They Live?
Yeah, They Live. I'm here to kick ass and chew bubble gum, and I'm all out of bubble gum.
All out of bubble gum. Oh, all out of bubble gum.
His best line. That movie's so bad. It's so bad, but I love it.
It's so bad, but it's so good. That's what makes it so good. And the 9-minute fight scene.
I forgot that fight scene never ends.
It doesn't. Love that show. But yeah, Rowdy Roddy Piper. You got me thinking about all the people that were in the. Oh, Michael Ironside. We had him on the show.
Yeah.
Michael Ironside being the one of the main he was in Starship Trooper.
Mm-hmm.
And Total Recall.
Yep. And Dark Man.
He was the bad guy of the 90s.
Oh, absolutely he was. So let me ask you this real quick. As a somebody who's worked in the film industry for as long as you have, can you still sit down and enjoy a movie without looking at how it's made?
Oh, yes. I don't know how I do it, but I can. Yeah. I have no problem
with it. So you're able to just separate those out?
Yeah, it's just that whole suspension of disbelief. You know, it's like what I just kind of put myself in that world. And if there's something glaring, of course, it'll bother me, but it takes a lot to, to pull me out of it.
Like floor scrubbers being used as defibrillator paddles?
Yeah, floor scrubbers being used as a defibrillator. Gosh, that's hilarious.
I've always said there's no bad props because, I don't want to make anybody mad, but when like they're glaringly obvious like that, it's like, okay, yeah, no, you're right. That's pretty terrible.
Well, no, you just gave me the opportunity.
No, and you ran with it and it was beautiful. No, it was fantastic.
Do we want to tell the audience? Okay. So,
By all means.
So Mike did a great TikTok explaining that there really are no bad props because they still push the story forward, they have a purpose and all that. And he's right, but then I just used your post as an excuse to stitch it to say I beg to differ.
Here's a
doctor using floor scrubbers
as a defibrillator. And I gotta be honest with you, you hit it out of the park because that was like a quality reaction, like response post, because I was like, yep, nope, can't argue with that. That's pretty shit.
Yep. Yeah, that's fair.
That is fair. So now, like you were on the original Walker for, I think you said 8 years you worked on that?
Yes.
And now, how long have you been on the current Walker?
We're just on our second season.
You're on your second season. So the big thing in the news right now, of course, is the IATSE strike. And for those who don't know, it's IATSE, which is essentially the union for people that work behind the scenes. And they have 98% voted to strike. Now, how obviously that's going to affect you, because if I'm not mistaken, Walker is a union production. So will that just bring everything to a grinding halt, or how does that work for you?
Well, the way I understand it best is the best way to describe it is, so it's not all union production. It's productions that are what is called the area standards agreement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically a blanket agreement that is made every few years between the producers and the crew in our union that states, okay, we should get 9 hours. So when we wrap, the crew member should get 9 hours off before he has to report back to work. You know, minimum of nine, right? Different rules like that. We get to break for one hour or 30 minutes. How does it work? Maybe it's 30 minutes. 30 minutes lunch. Some do 1 hour, but most 30.
Right.
But the way that works is everybody has to go through the line. So the whole crew, you're much better off if you're first in line for lunch, because once they call last man, that's a union thing. So when last man goes through the lunch line and has the plate in his or her hand, they boom start the time clock, the 30 minutes. So if you're first in line, you can get about a 45 minute lunch. Anyway, so there are all these lists of rules and. And they deal with pay and overtime and all that. And with the advent of streaming a few years ago, which was they devised a new media contract where your companies such as Netflix and of course Amazon, all these companies are getting into production. They said, we don't know if we're going to make any money at this. We can't afford what the networks pay, right?
Right.
And so they came up with a new media agreement, and it didn't have – there were a lot of things that didn't have in it that we were used to, which was I don't know. It was definitely reduced pay, but in addition to that, it was reduced health insurance. It was reduced pension pay pay into your pension, reduced, no holiday pay, stuff like that.
Right.
And it was definitely a bare bones contract. So they are wanting to still do that. But we're trying to get producers to make streaming be on the same level as the networks to where it's all one contract.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
If I'm saying it right, but I hope somebody responds and says I'm wrong. But that's in a nutshell, to where both sides need to come to an agreement, and hopefully they will. Now that they're, the producers see that we have authorized. That 98% of the members have authorized a strike. The producers will hopefully be more willing to negotiate.
Imagine
they weren't before.
By the time this airs, as I understand it, either the strike will be on, or negotiations will be reopened. So hopefully negotiations are reopened.
I believe negotiations. I don't have a laptop near me, but there was an article in Deadline saying that both sides have agreed to meet.
Okay.
To resume negotiations. So my guess is that in the next few days, we'll hear if it's if things are working out or not.
Well, hopefully
it doesn't come to us. Hopefully it doesn't come to a strike.
Yeah.
I'd hate to see
so many people that I've become friends with be out of work for any length of time. So I'm hoping that it also doesn't. I hope that the negotiations work out in the favor, particularly of the folks at IATSE.
Well, people need to understand it. It also covers it covers hair, makeup, props, camera department, directors of photography, and editors. So not only will it production cease, post-production will cease. Mm-hmm. So there, so even if a show is in the can and it's not, you know, it's not all put together, it won't get put back together unless they find non-union editors, I don't know. You got to find people that will cross the picket.
There aren't too many that are willing to do that. And I know that the writers...
Not if they ever intend to get...
If they ever intend to stay in it, yeah. Yeah. Now, I know the Writers Guild and the Screen Actors Guild have also stated that they will also strike if IATSE does. So that would shut down all of it. There would be nothing.
Well, happening. You know, back when the writers... there was a writer strike back, mm-hmm. I believe, in late 2006, 2007, 2008-ish. Yeah.
It's in that
and,
era.
It was our second season of Friday Night Lights. And it almost killed us because we weren't doing great in the ratings. But that was like the birth of streaming. That's when DirecTV picked us up, you know.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother story. So the writers struck, but our union said we were going to honor their picket line and stand in solidarity with them, right? So that's, you know, why you have the writers saying the same thing here, because we did right by them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just kind of a, you know, they're doing right by us.
Yeah.
You know, because we all, because it wasn't just writers that went a couple months without working. It was, or I don't know how long. It wasn't a couple months.
It wasn't very long.
I feel like maybe it was a month, but there were, you know, loopholes. So when the producers saw that a strike was imminent, I think it was more than a month. Now that I think about it, I think it only affected me for a month. That's just my memory is selfish because I'm thinking of how long I was off work.
Right.
So that was like early December. And then, producers were buying up scripts before the strike, right? So once they paid their money, it's their script.
Right.
Then they could start a production. So I feel like that's why they were able to start up a little bit early, where there was a loophole where the writers, I think they were doing better negotiations, so they allowed, now I can't remember how it worked. I feel like that there were movies that were starting back up before, but I think the negotiations were already, like, in the works.
Okay.
I feel like it was, like, January, so yeah, maybe it was a month. But yeah, it was scary because you don't know how long that stuff's going to go.
Right. Yeah, I've worked union shops before, we only went on strike one time, and it actually only ended up lasting for like 2 weeks. But it was that not knowing who was going to cave first kind of thing that mm-hmm. was really kind of terrifying, to not know if you were going to go back to work anytime soon. So hopefully the strike doesn't happen and nobody has to worry about that. So I'm hoping for the best for everybody out there, but. We are actually running towards the end of our time, Mr. Reeder. So if anybody would like to find you on the internet, where would they find you?
They would find me at Scott Prop and Roll on TikTok, Instagram, Scott Prop and Roll on YouTube.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really do appreciate it. And I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
This has been the Prop History Podcast.